Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A near record-breaking number of homicides, the crisis of opiate addiction, and strained relations between Columbus residents and police. All three issues are at stake in a proposed new plan to make the heart of Franklin County a little bit safer. Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther in early November unveiled his comprehensive neighborhood safety strategy and announced plans to end the controversial community safety initiative. Coming up, we'll hear from a community group, an expert on community policing, and a representative of the Columbus Fraternal Order of Police. Joining us now is Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning, Ann.
Before we get to the policing issue, I did want to ask you about the proposal by Doug Kreidler, president and CEO of the Columbus Foundation. Yesterday, he kind of backed away from his plan to try to prevent the crew from leaving the city for Austin after the 2018 season. He was hoping that it would at least have a butterfly effect, was the way he put it, and spur other ideas. Has it?
Well, quite honestly, you know, as I shared with Doug when he mentioned to me that he might be sharing this plan, many of the aspects of his plan were exactly what Alex Fisher and I shared with the commissioner of the league and with Mr. Precourt in New York a week or so ago. Mm-hmm. We talked about several different sites, many of them that have been reported throughout the city. We talked about, different opportunities for different local investors. Again, repeated the offer to buy the team for Mr. Precourt, but also to get additional local investment into the club as well as corporate sponsorship. The only condition that we made was stop pursuing Austin and commit to Columbus. Columbus is a community that is built on partnerships, relationships, and commitment. And we're not getting a bidding war with another great American city. And, you know, once the league and Mr. Precourt commit to Columbus, we stand ready, willing, and able. So many different aspects besides public funding. We didn't talk specifically in New York about the city or county putting resources into it, but public-private partnerships, infrastructure, potentially land, and many different sites that we discussed. So we talked about many specific things. I know that the commissioner and Mr. Precourt said there weren't any specific ideas or solutions or proposals. That's just not accurate. Mm-hmm. Alex and I took a series of them, and all we asked them for was one condition. And that is stop pursuing Austin and commit to Columbus so that we can make sure that the crew, you know, which has such a proud history in this community and within the league, that we could all make them successful and sustainable in the future.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You bet.
You've been in office since January 2016. What was the tipping point for the plan to establish this new initiative when it comes to policing?
It's a collective process. You know, we were purposeful and intentional this year as we saw this spike in homicides to get out in the community and meet with folks from across the spectrum, folks that, agreed with our point of view and those that didn't. Because I think it's important as mayor of the entire city is to be out there talking with and meeting with people who have different ideas and different viewpoints and take all those things into account. So we did roundtables around the city in each part of town. I met with the FOP, the People's Justice Project, the NAACP, and community groups across the city. And what I continue to hear from folks is, you know, the biggest challenges that we face are the spike in homicides, but also strained relationships between the community and law enforcement. And so when we were putting together this, you know, comprehensive neighborhood safety strategy, we wanted to make sure it reflected our shared belief that every resident deserves to be safe in the neighborhood that they live in. And so we wanted a comprehensive approach to violence. When you see a spike, we're at 120 homicides right now. Here are the facts. And I say this all the time because it's important for us as a community to hear this and for me to say it as mayor. 75% of the victims, of homicide victims this year, are African-American men between the ages of 18 and 40. 80% of the homicide victims have been killed by gunfire. We have a violence problem and a homicide problem in this community that is disproportionately negatively impacting African-American men in the minority community. And it isn't just the victims and the victims' families that suffer. And that's why we thought it was so important to, you know, have public health engaged in the Violent Crime Review Group, because this issue of violence is threatening family stability, neighborhood safety, and the quality of life of our neighborhoods for everybody.
The quality of life of the neighborhoods, the stability of the neighborhoods, the safety, that's been a long-term problem that's affected by the schools-to-prison pipeline, by guns, mm-hmm. Readily available in the city, and by poverty, extreme poverty.
And that's why we really feel strongly that our comprehensive approach is going to have the long-term impact of reducing violence and making it safer in our neighborhoods throughout our city. I mean, a good part of my overall focus as an administration has been on making sure that every family in every neighborhood shares in our success. Two-thirds of the people in Columbus are doing very well. But a third of our neighbors have not shared in the success story, especially since the recovery started in 2009, 2010. Fastest growing economy in the Midwest, lowest unemployment in 25 years, AAA bond rating from all three rating agencies. But at the same time, you have our opportunity neighborhoods that have disproportionately high infant mortality rates, disproportionate amount of poverty, disproportionate amount of violent crime. And so that's why, our focus on neighborhoods, reflects the comprehensive neighborhood safety strategy, the Celebrate One initiative, expanding high quality access to high quality early learning and preschool opportunities, expanding the use of after school programming and summer youth employment, and really trying to focus on the opportunity youth in our community right now in this county. There are 20,500 young people between the ages of 16 and 24 that aren't enrolled in any academic program and are not working a job.
You have charged the public safety director to double the number of minority police officers and firefighters over the next decade. They've been shooting for something like that for a long time. What have been the roadblocks? What do you know about that?
Well, nobody has set forth this ambitious of a goal.
No, they haven't. But even less ambitious goals have not been achieved.
And so it's important for us, it's our Celebrate One goals, our 2020 goals. It is important for us as a community. If diversity and inclusion is a key value and a high priority for me as mayor and for this community, you have to embed it in the culture of your organization. And so having this high, lofty, ambitious goal is important because it sets forth a clear expectation. It gives folks time to get there. In 10 years, to double the number of minorities and underrepresented folks within the Division of Police and Fire, because it's important to me that the Division of Police and Fire reflect the beautiful diversity of this community. And so we're going to take best practices, and we know this is an issue across the country. Mm-hmm. Attracting high quality candidates of color and from underrepresented backgrounds into law enforcement and into fire. And so it's going to take a evidence-based, best practice, long-term plan that we measure our success every year over that 10-year period of time. But it also means we're going to have to change the way we recruit, we test, evaluate, and target folks at an early age. And that's why we're expanding programs to expose young people, particularly young people of color, to positive interactions with law enforcement at the middle school. And our hope is to even grow it to the elementary school, where we have officers, our best and brightest from the Division of Police in schools across the community, having that first interaction with law enforcement be a positive one and talking to young people about careers in law enforcement.
How do you achieve reflecting the beautiful diversity of this community, which it arguably is, mm-hmm. when you won't allow women to wear hijabs on duty?
Well, it's something that we're going to continue to look at. And
that's not a done deal then? I mean, that's something that could change in the future?
It certainly could change in the future. I think there are lots of things that within the Division of Police and the Division of Fire that have changed over time. And it's something that, my belief is that if the military can figure it out and divisions of police across the country can figure it out, we ought to be setting the bar and leading by example if we really want to live up to our billing as being smart and open and wanting our first responders to reflect the diversity of this community. We need to evolve and figure it out.
What wasn't working with the Community Safety Initiative? You announced as well that you're going to put the kibosh on that.
Well, it wasn't necessarily that it wasn't working. We thought we could do more. You look at the Safe Streets initiative that Commander Knight led in Linden, and what happened there was by having more...
The pilot bike patrol.
So we had, in addition to our normal calls for service, our officers and their cruisers responding to calls for service in that community, we had officers on bikes out in the community. And I got to tell you, at Neighborhood Pride and community events in Linden, the residents there raved about it. And they thought that it was a great way to build trust between the community there, which has seen a disproportionate amount of violent crime over the years, including last night. But, you know, through that event, you know, hundreds and hundreds of tips came in from the community to police. Because one thing I didn't mention about that spike in homicides, half of the 120 homicides are unsolved and have no lead at this point.
And so, that's a function of that distrust, you think?
I think that's part of it, you know, because people fear potentially going to the police because of retribution from other elements, gangs and drug dealers in the community that might, you know, seek retribution against somebody that shares information with police, but also because of the divide that exists that we're working to overcome. So in addition to that, you have the Safe Neighborhoods initiative that actually was brought to the city from BRED and that has just started, you know, kind of doing an intervention with violent offenders that maybe are doing some things now that, at least based on the trajectory and their involvement with gangs and drug activity, are going to lead to more violent events in the future. Where we bring in partnership with the Department of Justice, U.S. Attorney's Office, the Prosecutor's Office, bring them in and say, here's a path. You can have resources, job training, we'll help you find employment and stability. The other path is this, and that is incarceration or death. And so that program, I think, is also going to help us get more folks, particularly younger folks that maybe are just getting involved with gangs and drug activity, on the right path.
You have plans to establish a $2 million fund to pay for the overtime for more bike and foot patrols, another $1.8 million for the neighborhood crisis response that includes the code enforcement issues, which are another thing we haven't talked about yet, school programs, streetlights. Is there any money I'm missing? I mean, and is this for just a two-year period or?
Well, this is the proposed budget for this year.
For 2018. Okay.
Yeah. And we're also going to provide, because we haven't really talked about the opiate crisis and the opiate action plan, because that's driving this too. I mean, when you have folks that are addicted, particularly addicted to opiates, it makes them much more desperate in their activity and things that they will do to feed that addiction. And so for the first time ever, the city is going to invest $1 million into the opiate action plan. So that's a plan led by David Royer and Dr. Mashika Roberts on the clinical side, Amy O'Grady on the non-clinical side, have led, you know, with the county and other partners to put together this comprehensive evidence-based plan for us to go after the opiate crisis, focusing on prevention, education, treatment, new strategies with law enforcement. So we're going to invest $1 million this year into the opiate action plan, $460,000 on Narcan for our first responders, $200,000 for that opiate czar position, and $322,000 for harm reduction initiatives. So this is a comprehensive approach because when you have a spike in homicides like this, it really takes a different approach to policing, investment, and really focusing on how we make things safer in our neighborhoods.
You're proposing several groups to analyze safety issues, a violent crime group, a neighborhood safety committee, a Columbus Community Safety Advisory Commission. It sounds like a lot of cooks in the kitchen. I'm also wondering what you're hoping to learn that you don't already know.
Well, I think there are a couple of different things. You know, the commission that we are going to create the Community Safety Advisory Commission. We're going to have folks go through an application process. We want community leaders from law enforcement, faith community, and neighborhood and community leaders to come together. And so we can have a very transparent and open review of our training, policies, and procedures for the Division of Police to make sure, you know, that we have that objective, an independent consultant to work with to look at things, look at the type of training. What are we doing around de-escalation? What are we doing around that crisis intervention training? Because, you know, in this commitment, we committed to make sure that half or to increase by 50% the number of officers that receive that CIT training, out on the streets in the next 3 years. We want to make sure that the officers we have the best possible training to deal with individuals and the challenges that they're going to face on the streets.
The Fraternal Order of Police Lodge Number 9 here in Columbus has cast a vote of no confidence against you, the chief, the city council. How have you been working on that other side of the equation?
Well, it's so important. I'm not going to speak to that. That's their decision, their thing. When you're the mayor of the city of Columbus, you can't get into those things. Your job is to get people together to take on and solve tough problems. And so,
Are you convinced that the police are willing to take on and solve these tough problems
absolutely. When
they have this vote of no confidence?
Absolutely,
though?
Absolutely. That vote, I don't pay attention to that. This is what I know, that we have some of the best men and women in America who get up every day and joined the Division of Police to make a difference and help people stay safe. So I hear from those folks every day. I continue to work with those. I sat down with the FOP president just a couple of months ago. We talked in depth about this kind of approach. He obviously has made very clear he wants additional officers. I think, we're very supportive. We've got two classes in this comprehensive approach, but we can't police our way out of the violence and the homicide spike in our community. We've got to have this comprehensive neighborhood safety strategy to do the prevention, the intervention, and the enforcement to make sure that, we have a very small percentage of our citizens that are committing an overwhelming, disproportionate amount of the crime. And so we've got to focus on getting these crimes solved, these homicides solved, getting those folks off the street, but also having this comprehensive neighborhood safety strategy that involves, our CARE coalition and public health, development, and our department and neighborhoods, really going after the quality of life in our neighborhoods that have been left out of our success story.
Mayor Ginther, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
That's Mayor Andrew Ginther of Columbus. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about community policing, and the uptick in violence in Columbus, what to do about it. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A near record-breaking homicide rate, the crushing crisis of opiate addiction, and strained relations between Columbus residents and police. All three issues are at stake in a proposed new strategy to improve safety in the city. At the heart of Franklin County, Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther in early November announced what he called his comprehensive neighborhood safety strategy. He said the new raft of programs will replace the city's controversial community safety initiative. We just heard from Mayor Ginther. Coming up, we'll hear from the president of the Columbus Fraternal Order of Police. Joining us now from the local social justice group People's Justice Project is Amber Evans. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And by phone is author and professor in the Department of Criminology, Anthropology, and Sociology at Cleveland State University, James Criss. His 2013 book is entitled Beyond Community Policing, From Early American Beginnings to the 21st Century. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The terms community and policing and safety are always being thrown together these days. What's the connection? Why do we call it community policing? What hasn't it always been?
Oh, That's addressed to me?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I tell you, from the subtitle of my book, From Early American Beginnings to the 21st Century, I do a fairly broad look at the historical development of something called policing. And it's gone through these three, now four eras. And I can just tell you real briefly that the first era, the so-called political spoils era, which ran from about 1830 to 1920, was absolutely lodged in the political structure of a local community. Policing was overwhelmingly a political function. And since there were no screening or recruitment policies in place, the only thing that happened was the mayor and the city council and ward bosses are the guys who pick police and so forth. And so they carried out whatever functions were needed, and it was mainly order. It was within the context of a very homogeneous situation where everybody was pretty similar and so forth. By the 1920s, the second era of reform and early professionalization, there started appearing some new kind of things in the air regarding diversity in communities. So you started getting, especially in urban communities, you started getting a lot more diversity. And police, who are already doing a lot of different things in the first era, especially involving close relations with citizens and leading to patronage abuses and corruption and so forth, they decided to try to clean up policing. And so the second era of policing tried to specialize in law enforcement. They called themselves crime fighters. This was in opposition to the broader mandate of the first era, which was just the peace officer, which allows you to do all sorts of stuff. That worked okay in terms of professionalization and upgrading of tasks and accountability to the citizenry. But by the 1960s, what happened? Well, what happened was that we had an era of tumult where there were a lot of social movement actors coming into high-profile conflict with police who were the guardians of the status quo. And in the 1960s, the call came out to, hey, man, you can't just be crime fighters. You can't just be hard asses coming down on people enforcing the law. You got to do more. And also, you guys are out of step with the community. The community's become much more diverse, and you guys are basically just white males. Mm-hmm. And so the community policing era, which started in the 60s and 70s, was a far-flung change of approach regarding the kind of mandate that police ought to take for themselves, especially with regard to the collaboration of community members and viewing the police department as a resource for community betterment and development. This is something kind of new that is still being worked out and is still unclear how well we can use police in that capacity.
Sometimes I think about what we're asking of police is a lot of the sort of same things. There's parallels with what we are asking of teachers. We're asking them to do a lot more than just keep the order and fight crime.
Yeah, right. The community policing mandate is very diffuse, and police are wearing multiple hats. They're being asked to become not just crime fighters or keeping the peace or mm-hmm. providing services, but also, you know, social workers. You know, with a new kind of impulse toward recruiting a better class of people and having a higher level of formal education, we're also asking police to multitask and to be familiar with not only the wide range of technologies they work with, the so-called hard skills, but also the soft skills of human relations mm-hmm. and dealing with an increasingly diverse citizenry and providing various services, niche services for a variety of parts of the citizenry that may need these, whether it's mental health issues or other sorts of things. And you know, so yeah, it's quite an amazing array of things that are going on in the community policing era right now.
Amber Evans, from where you sit, organizer for the local social justice group People's Justice Project, which is on the streets trying to work and diffuse tensions and avoid violence on the streets. What do you make of this proposed iteration that the mayor has put forth?
First, thank you, Anne, again.
Sure.
I think for us, it's really about, it's always hard when we talk about feeling joyful after organizing around so much death. But it really is for us a recognition that organizing works, and especially for the families that have been affected by this initiative. So what we find is that a lot of the social power that we've built, the community power that we've built over time after the death of Henry Green and Tyree King, has really uplifted our demands. So ending the Jump Out Boys or the Community Safety Initiative was one.
Okay, so you're very happy about that.
Yes, because for a long time it's plagued communities of color and low-income communities. And there's been a lot of work over the years that community members have done fighting for this. So that's a win for us. Also looking at the fact that now officers are going to be required to have CIT training. It's only 50%, but we're pushing for 100% of
those.
And
again, the CIT is?
Crisis intervention training, yes. And unfortunately, in the case of Jerron Thomas, we didn't see that. He passed away after calling 911 for a mental health crisis. And police responded, and eventually he fell into a coma after some of the injuries that he sustained from them trying to, quote-unquote, arrest him. So for us, it's really thinking about, too, this $250 investment that went into the CARE Coalition. Right now, the CARE Coalition is organized under this broad brush of trauma. But for us, we're really pushing for a concentrated focus on gun violence and police violence. One thing that the CARE Coalition does uplift is incarceration is also a risk of untreated trauma and grief. And so going back to the gentleman that you had speak before me, mm-hmm. one thing that he mentioned was if we have a lot of money in policing, then police also become the enforcer, the counselor, the social worker. And what we're really calling for is to have more money into counseling and social workers. So counseling over handcuffs, over cops. And then I think for us really trying to hit home on the fact that the advisory commission that the mayor has put forth really needs to be 6 of 11 of those members directly affected family members by police violence and gun violence.
What's the magic in 6?
So for us, 6 is the majority.
Okay.
If it was 10, it would be 5 and 5. But with 6, we would have enough of a voice of directly affected folks, recognizing that they're experts of their experience. They're the ones that should be at the forefront.
Jim, Chris, let's talk a little bit about the gun violence issue. You know, back in the 1830s to 1920s, probably well into the 1960s, guns did not play the role that they do today. I mean, that's a part of the equation that I don't really see anybody addressing anywhere in any of this.
Well, actually, unlike many other parts of the world, the Western world, most police departments starting in the 1830s, we're talking about Boston and New York City and Philadelphia, they pretty much from the get-go issued side revolvers to their officers. Now, obviously, in the first iteration that occurred in London, Robert Peel's Metropolitan Police, they did not issue firearms. So we've got to be a little bit careful about if we look at the historical development of policing, especially as it developed in the opening of the Western frontier. I have a chapter on policing in the Wild West. There was massive emphasis placed on guns. And even though police attempted to try to, like in Wichita in 1870, the sheriff tried to say, hey, man, deposit your guns in this here basket. We're not allowed to bring guns into the city of Wichita. It didn't work. You know, I mean, but what we do know is that if we believe Egon Bittner, the great police sociologist who said that the core of the police role is the distribution of non-negotiable force, police are sworn law enforcement officers. They have arrest powers. They are the ones who can intervene and seize people and detain them and possibly arrest them without kind of the messiness that's involved in like citizen arrests and so forth. So we've set aside these specialized agents who carry out this legal control function for society. And for many decades, their word was gold in terms of they had the power of the police report and so forth. Mm-hmm. It was only until later in the second era and beyond that we started trying to get some notion of external accountability, holding the police accountable because of the massive power that they're vested in by the state. go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask Amber Evans if she what your thoughts are about is this. Do you feel like there's a change afoot? Does it feel different?
It doesn't feel different because we have 118 homicides still in all
120 as of last night.
120. Yeah. Thank you. And those even if the city's focus and priorities are on the west of Columbus and in Linden, those two homicides, one happened in Linden and one happened on the West Side. Mm-hmm. And so I think for us, when we look at the mayor's budget, 1.2% roughly is going into community programming, whereas an estimated 67.5% is going into policing. And so it's like this gross disparate number that is really not getting to the root issue, which is untreated trauma and grief. And the mayor mentioned we can't police our way out of the problem, but how is that being reflected in his budget?
Okay. What about the emphasis on more diversity in the police and firefighter force?
Again, it's really not about changing the face of the police. It's about changing the culture. And when the mayor mentioned wanting to really focus on recruiting at younger ages or exposure for younger ages.
Getting into the elementary.
Exactly. And, yeah. That to us is really harmful because these are the same children that are going into their communities and seeing 13-year-old Tyree King, who a lot of them knew, shot and killed by police. It's traumatic. And it's not getting to the root issue or the root cause, which, again, is not going to be solved by expanding police and also by bringing the same officers that are in their communities in their schools. It's going to take away from their learning.
So you don't think that's a good idea at all?
No, again, because it's not addressing the root cause, which is our culture in the Columbus Police Department, not, again, changing the face or the color of the police.
Christopher in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Christopher.
Oh, hi. That was quick. Thank you, Ann.
But I'm interested in what you want to ask about.
Oh, I just was going to comment that, you know, if the police would work together to get rid of the rogue cops, they wouldn't need to work so hard to get along with the community because the community would embrace them.
I wanted to end. Thank you, Christopher, for that. James, Chris, what about that? I mean, what's the history been of, you know, self-cleaning, weeding out, you know, from within?
Well, yeah, I mean, August Vollmer, the great revolutionary visionary of policing from the second era, basically, you know, he kind of laid down the gauntlet in the 1930s and said, well, you know, a lot of police practices are quite suspect, whether it's harsh interrogation, the so-called third degree. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that set the stage for continuing kind of an external accountability where you had commissions and so forth being impaneled to look at the activities of the police. And then, you know, by the 60s and 70s with police commissions in New York City and elsewhere, they claim to find widespread so-called grass eating. The grass eating is where police are not directly involved in corruption or brutality or illegality, but they're looking the other way. And
right.
So they're creating this subcultural edifice to kind of, well, it's the no comment kind of culture where you but they also discovered that there are a few meat eaters. Meat eaters are the rogue cops who are actually engaged in direct corruption and brutality and so forth. And there was supposed to be put mechanisms into place through internal affairs and so forth to try to keep a running check on this and to eliminate the grass-eating culture and to make policing more transparent. It seems like since the 1970s, especially with the advent of community policing and greater accountability, such as with there's some citizen oversight in some communities.
Mm-hmm.
I think, look, I'm not going to get into the big debate about how widespread corruption or illegality is in policing. Some research suggests that at any given time, about 97% of policing is upfront and legitimate, and about 3% is corrupt. If you expand that out to the total number of sworn officers, that still accounts for a lot of bad issues.
Yeah,
so,
if you're on the receiving end
is,
of it. But I just wanted to ask Amber Evans just before we let her go. You know, the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge Number 9 has cast a vote of no confidence against the mayor, the council, safety department. It sounds like you're on the opposite side of the same coin. Have you anything in common with Fraternal Order of Police? We're going to hear from the president in a few minutes. Amber Evans?
Yeah, I think going back to what the mayor said, is he said he's focused more on working with community and working with partners that want to achieve a safer, better Columbus for all. However, what we recognize is that in order for that to happen, the FOP contract is coming up to be signed. Mm-hmm. And what we're lifting is that the amount of time that they have to make a statement needs to be reduced, as well as an elimination of expungement. After 3 years, complaints that are filed against officers can be expunged from their records, as well as mandatory drug testing. So for us, we do not align with the FOP, again, because they have protected and have launched a campaign called Support Rosen, which is for former officer Zachary Rosen, who shot and killed Henry Green and was seen stomping DeMarco Anderson, a black restrained civilian. So we do not support that at all. But we do lift the fact that the FOP contract, in order to change the culture of policing, which is the root issue and the root cause of what we're experiencing, needs to start with the elimination of that expungement clause, as well as mandatory drug testing, and the amount of time that they have to make a statement should be reduced.
Amber Evans, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
That's Amber Evans. She's an organizer for the local social justice group, People's Justice Project. Coming up, we're going to hear from the president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge Number 9. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The near record-breaking homicide rate, the crushing crisis of opiate addiction and strained relations between Columbus residents and police, all three issues are at stake in a proposed new strategy to improve safety in the city at the heart of Franklin County. Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther in early November announced what he called his comprehensive neighborhood strategy, safety strategy. He said the new raft of programs in part will replace the city's controversial community safety initiative. We heard from Mayor Ginther earlier in the program. We just heard from a member of the People's Justice Project. Still with us by phone is professor of criminology at Cleveland State University and author of the 2013 book, Beyond Community Policing, From Early American Beginnings to the 21st Century, Jim Criss. Also joining us now is president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge Number 9, Jason Pappas. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you for having me.
Relations between the community and police aren't great. We've talked about this before. Everyone is calling for police chief Kim Jacobs' head, it seems like. Your group has cast a vote of no confidence against her and the mayor and the council. What are your concerns?
Well, let me just start with the premise of the conversation here that the community relationships are strained with police, and I'd refute that.
Okay.
So I can tell you anecdotally that I have been out in uniform a number of times lately. Many people thank us, shake our hands, and thank us for our service as they walk by. I've had numerous people offer to buy my lunch or my coffee or whatever the case
may
be.
And you've refused.
I have refused, of course. And but the sentiment is there. And I think that's true throughout just about all aspects of Franklin County law enforcement, not just Columbus. Does that mean that there are pockets where we do have some issues between the community? Absolutely, there are some issues. But a large part of this is a segment of our population that doesn't want to take responsibility for their actions, and they want to blame others for the problems that they face. The police are not a problem solver for all of society's ills, and there's a lot of things that need to be corrected in our community.
Do you think too much is being asked of police? I was mentioning earlier to Jim Criss that there's a parallel for me between all of the things that are asked of police and all of the things that are, for instance, asked of teachers, that they're not just teaching, they're social workers, they're school nurses, they're psychologists, they're
absolutely
counselors, they're, you know, they provide clothing and you know, school supplies in many cases.
Sure. Well, and we do the same things. We have become more counselors than we have law enforcement officers in a lot of regards.
Is that a problem?
It's a major problem for multiple reasons. It stretches our resources immensely. Where we used to just handle law enforcement activities. We have become social workers today. We get calls for all sorts of things that are not police related, family issues, squabbles between siblings. But a lot of time is spent on mental health. And we have spent so much time on mental health that now the call is for all of our officers to be CIT trained.
Crisis intervention training, right?
Correct. And all of that training takes us away from the street, which, again, is a strain of the resources.
But so many problems on the streets and in the jails and the prisons revolve around mental health and also drug addiction.
Yeah, we agree. Absolutely agree. And where all of that comes to the street where we are located. So, you know, we're the easiest phone call. You can't get a counseling session at 11:30 at night when someone's in crisis, but you can call the police. Mm-hmm. And so we spend an inordinate amount of time using our resources outside of law enforcement activities.
The public safety director is supposed to come up with a plan to double the number of minority police officers and firefighters over the next decade, which seems like a long time especially to younger people. But what do you think might work in that regard? How do you attract more? You know, the mayor said there's been nothing this ambitious in the past. True, but even less ambitious goals have not been met.
Well, it is a complex measure, and I will tell you that's not a Columbus issue. It doesn't matter where you go across the country. Recruiting is down generally across the country, but minority recruiting is especially difficult given the culture that we have. And so it is extremely it's a tough task. If you look at our numbers and did the replacement value and the number of people that we're putting through the academy, it's almost an impossibility to come to the conclusion that we'll reach that goal. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't strive to reach it. You know, I've provided input to the city on what my thoughts were on recruiting issues. And hopefully some of those pan out. We don't look at race as an issue. Who's ever qualified is qualified, and we support any person who is able to meet our standards.
But it's understandable that the people out there in the community want to see someone who looks like them once in a while.
Sure, but I think they want a well-qualified, well-trained individual to respond to a crisis, and I don't think they care otherwise.
Jim, Chris, you were talking about how they went towards more diversity in police forces back in the 20s during that reformist era. What were they diversifying? Because it certainly didn't have anything to do with ethnicity, or maybe it had to do with ethnicity, but didn't have anything to do with race.
Well, that second era between 20 and 60, reform and early professionalization, mm-hmm. was really more concerned with reforming problems of the previous era with regard to police and citizens having too close and chummy relations.
Okay.
So there was an attempt to professionalize and upgrade. And one way you move toward professionalization is away from being a generalist, the jack of all trades, and toward a specialist. The police decided in the second era to divest themselves of all these other civil entanglements or social issues. I mean, even then, Vollmer realized that we cannot solve the problems of society. We can try to improve quality of life and so forth, and this has become a real big buzzword in the third era. But no, there wasn't much emphasis yet placed on ideas concerning upgrading the recruitment of officers and trying to, you know, get a more diverse officer corps. That really didn't start happening until the third community oriented era of policing. And that came out of, again, the tumultuous social movements of the 1960s, where there were the media was covering high profile clashes between police and citizens. And for the first time, we started having notions of police brutality and so forth. And then we start noticing that in some urban communities that were increasingly diversified in terms of race and ethnicity and mm-hmm. other factors, a largely white male police force was supervising and overseeing an increasingly diverse citizenry. So that's when calls started going out about trying to change recruitment practices and trying to bring in a better brand of citizens.
More professional. It sounds like you and Jason Pappas are talking about the same kind of a thing as far as that goes. When I was talking to Amber Evans of People's Justice Project, she said that they were happy that the city's going to put the kibosh on the community safety initiative. How does the FOP respond to that?
I think that's a shame. The fact of the matter is that safety initiative prevented a tremendous amount of crime and took a lot of bad people off the streets, a lot of guns, a lot of drugs. And if you go back and look at the program itself, the Division of Police does a really good job with evaluating itself and looking to make improvement. And if you look back over time, that program has changed significantly from year to year to year. And one of the things that they do is they actually communicate with the people who live in the community and ask them to complete surveys about how well they've done. And remarkably, the surveys are fantastic. The people who live in the communities enjoy the relationships when they have good relationships with the police, and they want them there and they want them doing the work. It's very difficult to speak out for some of those people because of the negative reaction that they'll get.
You want to keep them anonymous.
Correct.
Right.
But if you go back and you actually look at the surveys, you'll find that the people in those neighborhoods are very supportive of that program.
What about the idea the mayor talked about extending positive role model experiences for children from into the junior high and even elementary schools? Amber Evans said that could further traumatize a lot of kids who are struggling with bad, negative, experiences with police.
Well, I think
how do you feel about that?
I think you'll find that she and I are on opposite ends of the spectrum on just about every
True.
Issue. And so I will say that's, again, completely false. I think there's nothing better than having relationships. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. More police community interaction. Even in the mayor's outline of the things is his comprehensive neighborhood strategy, there are commissions and other groups together, including law enforcement, to address some of the issues that are going on. Divesting yourself of the community that you're trying to build relationships does not make any sense to me at all. I believe that we should be in those schools. The one thing where I'm having a little bit of an issue, the same with the recruiting and some of this neighborhood safety plan that the mayor has put forth, isn't the plan itself, is how we're going to implement it. And talking about putting more officers in schools requires more officers.
Right,
and we're not there
my
yet.
Next question is right. Number one, and that underscores, more overtime for bike and foot patrols. That's one thing, but that's always a short-term patch job, because ultimately you want more foot and bike patrol, not more overtime for foot and bike patrol.
Right. So I believe that the best way to develop those relationships and make lasting impressions in the community is to have more officers in the community doing really positive work.
And there's no long-term funding to increase that per se, is there?
No, not that I'm aware of. In fact, we did some research early in the year when we talked about the budget process, and we have the same number of officers today as we did 10 years ago. And we're continuing, again, to implement new strategies and more training, and the state's requiring more, and it's just stretching us more thin and more thin. And ultimately, we're doing less now. And I think that's a detriment to the community as a whole. I think it's time to staff the division appropriately so that we can do those things, including the mayor's plan here.
I would imagine some officers like the overtime financially, but do they? What's it like to work overtime as a police officer if you're already under stress?
Sure. Well, yeah, everyone likes a little bit of overtime,
yeah.
Right? It's nice.
I don't get it, but yeah.
I don't either, Ann, but I did when I was a younger officer, and I worked in the detective bureau, and there are times I made significant amounts of money in overtime. But the fact of the matter is I left that unit because after a couple of years, it's so disruptive to your family and to your other, your physical well-being. You just can't tolerate overtime in lengthy periods of time like that.
Yeah.
And so, again, it comes to a point where you look at not just the number of officers, but the quality of life and the well-being of the officers and the citizens. And you have to make some adjustments, and we think it's that time.
Well, that is all the time we have today. James, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks very much.
James Chris, an author and professor in the Department of Criminology, Anthropology, and Sociology at Cleveland State University. His 2013 book is entitled Beyond Community Policing, From Early American Beginnings to the 21st Century. Also, Jason Pappas, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
Jason Pappas is president of the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge No. 9. We'll continue our conversation about efforts to improve community police relations and get at this crime and violence wave in the city of Columbus. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.